14. There was nothing to do but return to Boise. I'd been defeated, not by powerful, experienced Sam K. Barrows, not by my partner, Maury Rock, either, but by 18-year-old Pris. There was no use hanging around Seattle. What lay ahead for me? Back to R&R Associates, make peace with Maury, resume where I had left off. Back to work on the Civil War soldier babysitter. Back to working for harsh, grim, bad-tempered Edwin M. Stanton. Back to having to put up with interminable readings aloud by the Lincoln simulacrum from Winnie the Pooh and Peter Pan. Once more, the smell of Corinna Lark's cigars, and, now and then, the sweeter smell of my father's A&Cs. The world I had left, the electronic organ and spinet factory at Boise, our office in Ontario. And there was always the possibility that Maury would not let me come back, that he was serious about breaking up the partnership. So I might find myself without even the same drab world I had known and left. I might not even have that to look forward to. Maybe now is the time. The moment to get out the 38 and blow off the top of my head, instead of returning to Boise. The metabolism of my body was speeding up and slowing down. I was breaking up due to centrifugal force, and at the same time, I groped out, trying to catch hold of everything near me. Pris had me, and yet in the instant of having me, she flung me away, ejected me in a fit of cursing and retching. It was as if the magnet attracted particles which it simultaneously repelled. I was caught in a deadly oscillation. Meanwhile, Pris continued on without noticing. The meaning of my life was at last clear to me. I was doomed to loving something beyond life itself, a cruel, cold, and sterile thing-thing, Pris Frauenzimmer. It would have been better to hate the entire world. In view of the near hopelessness of my situation, I decided to try one final measure. Before I gave up, I would try the Lincoln simulacrum. It had helped before. Maybe it could help me now. "This is Louis again," I said when I had gotten hold of Maury. "I want you to drive the Lincoln to the airfield and put it on a rocket flight to Seattle right now. I want the loan of it for about 24 hours. He put up a rapid, frantic argument. We fought it out for half an hour. But at last he gave in. When I hung up the phone, I had his promise that the Lincoln would be on the Seattle Boeing 900 by nightfall. Exhausted, I lay down to recover. If it can't find this motel, I decided, it probably wouldn't be of use anyhow. I'll lie here and rest. The irony was that Pris had designed it. Now we'll make back some of our investment, I said to myself. It cost us plenty to build, and we didn't manage to make a deal with Barrows. All it does is sit around all day reading aloud and chuckling. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I recalled an anecdote having to do with Abe Lincoln and girls. Some particular girl he had had a crush on in his youth. Successful? For God's sake. I couldn't recall how he had come out. All I could dredge up was that he had suffered a good deal because of it. Like me, I said to myself. Lincoln and I have a lot in common. Women have given us a bad time, so he'd be sympathetic. What should I do until the simulacrum arrived? It was risky to stay in my motel room. Go to the Seattle Public Library and read up on Lincoln's courtship and his youth? I told the motel manager where I'd be if someone looking like Abraham Lincoln came by looking for me, and then I called a cab and started out. I had a large amount of time to kill. It was only 10 o'clock in the morning. There's hope yet, I told myself as the cab carried me through traffic to the library. I'm not giving up. Not while I have the Lincoln to help bail me out of my problems. One of the finest presidents in American history, and a superb lawyer as well. Who could ask for more? If anybody can help me, Abraham Lincoln can. The reference books in the Seattle Public Library did not do much to sustain my mood. According to them, Abe Lincoln had been turned down by the girl he loved. He had been so despondent that he had gone into a near-psychotic melancholia for months. He had almost done away with himself, and the incident had left emotional scars on him for the remainder of his life. Great, I thought grimly as I closed the books. Just what I need, someone who's a bigger failure than I am. But it was too late. The simulacrum was on its way from Boise. Maybe we'll both kill ourselves, I said to myself as I left the library. We'll look over a few old love letters, and then, blam, with the 38. On the other hand, he had been successful afterward. He had become a president of the United States. To me, that meant that after nearly killing yourself with grief over a woman, you could go on, rise above it, although, of course, never forget it. It would continue to shape the course of your life. You'd be a deeper, more thoughtful person. I had noticed that melancholy in the Lincoln. Probably, I'd go to my grave the same sort of figure. However, that would take years, and I had right now to consider. I walked the streets of Seattle until I found a bookstore which sold paperbacks. There I bought a set of Carl Sandburg's version of Lincoln's Life and carried it back to my motel room, where I made myself comfortable with a six-pack of beer and a big sack of potato chips. In particular, I scrutinized the part dealing with Lincoln's adolescence and the girl in question, Anne Rutledge. But something in Sandburg's way of writing kept blurring the point. He seemed to talk around the matter. So I left the books, the beer, and the potato chips, and took a cab back to the library and the reference books there. It was now early in the afternoon. The affair with Anne Rutledge, after her death from malaria in 1835, at the age of 19, Lincoln had fallen into what the Britannica called a state of morbid depression, which appeared to have given rise to the report that he had a streak of insanity. Apparently, he himself felt a terror of this side of his makeup, a terror which is revealed in the most mysterious of his experiences several years later. That several years later was the event in 1841. In 1840, Lincoln got engaged to a good-looking girl named Mary Todd. He was then 29. But suddenly, on January 1st of 1841, he cut off the engagement. A date had been set for the wedding. The bride had on the usual costume. All was in readiness. Lincoln, however, did not show up. Friends went to see what happened. They found him in a state of insanity. And his recovery from this state was very slow. On January 23rd, he wrote to his friend John T. Stewart.
I am now the most miserable man living. If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there would not be one cheerful face on the earth. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell. I awfully forebode I shall not. To remain as I am is impossible. I must die or be better, it appears to me.
And in a previous letter to Stewart, dated January 20th, Lincoln says,
I have, within the last few days, been making a most discreditable exhibition of myself in the way of hypochondriacism, and thereby got an impression that Dr. Henry is necessary to my existence. Unless he gets that place, he leaves Springfield. You, therefore, see how much I am interested in this matter.
The matter is getting Dr. Henry appointed as postmaster at Springfield, so he can be around to keep tinkering with Lincoln in order to keep him alive. In other words, Lincoln, at that point in his life, was on the verge of suicide or insanity, or both together. Sitting there in the Seattle Public Library with all the reference books spread out around me, I came to the conclusion that Lincoln was what they now call a manic depressive psychotic. The most interesting comment is made by the Britannica and goes as follows. All his life long, there was a certain remoteness in him, a something that made him not quite a realist, but which was so veiled by apparent realism that careless people did not perceive it. He did not care whether they perceived it or not, was willing to drift along, permitting circumstances to play the main part in determining his course, and not stopping to split hairs as to whether his earthly attachments sprang from genuine realistic perceptions of affinity or from approximation more or less to the dreams of his spirit. And then the Britannica commences on the part about Anne Rutledge. It also adds this. They revealed the profound sensibility, also the vein of melancholy and unrestrained emotional reaction which came and went, in alternation with boisterous mirth, to the end of his days. Later, in his political speeches, he engaged in biting sarcasm, a trait, I discovered after research, found in manic depressives. And the alternation of boisterous mirth with melancholy is the basis of the manic depressive classification. But what undermines this diagnosis of mine is the following ominous note. Reticence, degenerating at times into secretiveness, is one of his fixed characteristics. And his capacity for what Stevenson called a large and genial idleness is worth considering. But the most ominous part of all deals with his indecision, because that isn't a symptom of manic depression. That's a symptom, if it's a symptom at all, of the introverted psychosis, of schizophrenia. It was now 5:30 in the afternoon, time for dinner. I was stiff and my eyes and head ached. I put the reference books away, thanked the librarian, and made my way out onto the cold, windswept sidewalk in search of a place to eat dinner. Clearly, I had asked Maury for the use of one of the deepest, most complicated humans in history. As I sat in the restaurant that evening, eating dinner, and it was a good dinner, I mulled it over in my mind. Lincoln was exactly like me. I might have been reading my own biography there in the library. Psychologically, we were as alike as two peas in a pod, and by understanding him, I understood myself. Lincoln had taken everything hard. He might have been remote, but he was not dead emotionally, quite the contrary. So he was the opposite of Pris, of the cold schizoid type. Grief, emotional empathy, were written on his face. He fully felt the sorrows of the war, every single death. So it was hard to believe that what the Britannica called his remoteness was a sign of schizophrenia. The same with his well-known indecision. And in addition, I had my own personal experience with him, or to be more exact, with his simulacrum. I didn't catch the alienness, the otherness, with the simulacrum that I had caught with Pris. I had a natural trust and liking for Lincoln, and that was certainly the opposite to what I felt toward Pris. There was something innately good and warm and human about him, a vulnerability, and I knew, by my own experience with Pris, that the schizoid was not vulnerable. He was withdrawn to safety, to a point where he could observe other humans, could watch them in a scientific manner without jeopardizing himself. The essence of someone like Pris lay in the matter of distance. Her main fear, I could see, was of closeness to other people. And that fear bordered on suspicion of them, assigning motives to their actions, which they didn't actually have. She and I were so different. I could see she might switch and become paranoid at any time. She had no knowledge of authentic human nature, none of the easy, day-to-day encounter with people that Lincoln had acquired in his youth. In the final analysis, that was what distinguished the two of them. Lincoln knew the paradoxes of the human soul, its great parts, its weak parts, its lusts, its nobility, all the odd-shaped pieces that went to make it up in its almost infinite variety. He had bummed around. Pris, she had an ironclad, rigid, schematic view, a blueprint of mankind, an abstraction, and she lived in it. No wonder she was impossible to reach. In the final analysis, that was what distinguished the two of them. Lincoln knew the paradoxes of the human soul, its great parts, its weak parts, its lusts, its nobility, all the odd-shaped pieces that went to make it up in its almost infinite variety. He had bummed around. Pris, she had an ironclad, rigid, schematic view, a blueprint of mankind, an abstraction, and she lived in it. No wonder she was impossible to reach. I finished my dinner, left the tip, paid the bill, and walked back outside onto the dark evening sidewalk. Where now? To the motel once more. I attracted a cab, and soon I was riding across town. When I reached the motel, I saw lights on in my room. The manager hurried out of his office and greeted me. You have a caller. My God, he sure does look like Lincoln, like you said. What is this, a gag or something? I let him in. Thanks, I said, and went on into the motel room. There, in a chair, Leaning back with his long legs stuck out before him, sat the Lincoln simulacrum. He was engrossed, unaware of me. He was reading the Carl Sandburg biography. Beside him on the floor rested a little cloth bag, his luggage. "Mr. Lincoln," I said. Presently he glanced up, smiled at me.
"Good evening, Louis."
"What do you think of the Sandburg book?"
"I have not yet had time to form an opinion."
He marked his place in the book, closed it, and put it aside.
"Maury told me that you are in grave difficulty and required my presence and advice. I hope I have not arrived too lately on the scene."
"No, you made good time. How did you like the flight from Boise?"
"I was taken with astonishment to observe the fast motion of the landscape beneath. We had hardly risen when we were already here and landing, and the shepherdess told me that we had gone over 1,000 miles.
I was puzzled. "Oh, stewardess."
"Yes. Forgive my stupidity."
"Can I pour you a drink?" I indicated the beer, but the simulacrum shook its head no.
"I would prefer to decline. Why don't you present me with your problems, Louis, and we will see at once what is to be done."
With a sympathetic expression, the simulacrum waited to hear. I seated myself facing him, but I hesitated. After what I had read today, I wondered if I wanted to consult with him after all, not because I did not have faith in his opinions, but because my problem might stir up his own buried sorrows. My situation was too much like his own with Ann Rutledge.
"Go ahead, Louis."
Let me fix myself a beer first. With the opener, I set to work on the can. I fooled with that for a time, wondering what to do.
"Perhaps I should speak, then. During my trip from Boise, I had certain meditations on the situation with Mr. Barrows."
Bending, he opened his overnight bag and brought out several lined pages on which he had written in pencil.
"Do you desire to put great force to bear against Mr. Barrows, so that he will, of his own will, send back Ms. Frauenzimmer, no matter how she may feel about it?"
I nodded.
"Then,"
the simulacrum said,
"telephone this person."
He passed me a slip of paper. On it was a name. Sylvia Dvorak. I could not for the life of me place the name. I had heard it before, but I couldn't make the connection.
"Tell her,"
the simulacrum went on softly,
"that you would like to visit her in her home and discuss a matter of delicacy, a topic having to do with Mr. Barrows. That will be enough. She will at once invite you over."
"What then?"
"I will accompany you. There will be no problem, I think. You need not resort to any fictitious account with her. You need only describe your relationship with Miss Frauenzimmer, that you represent her father, and that you have profound emotional attachments toward the girl yourself."
I was mystified. Who is this Sylvia Dvorak?
"She is the political antagonist of Mr. Barrows. It is she who seeks to condemn the Green Peach Hat housing, which he owns, and from which he derives enormous rents. She is a socially inclined lady, given to worthy projects."
The simulacrum passed me a handful of newspaper clippings from Seattle papers.
"I obtained these through Mr. Stanton's assistance. As you can see from them, Mrs. Dvorak is tireless, and she is quite astute."
"You mean," I said, "that this business about Pris being under the age of consent and a mentally ill ward of the federal government?"
"I mean, Louis, that Mrs. Dvorak will know what to do with the information which you bring to her."
After a moment, I said, "Is it worth it?" I felt weighed down. To do a thing like that.
"Only God can be certain,"
the simulacrum said. "What's your opinion?"
"Pris is the woman whom you love. Is that not the actual fact of the matter? What is there in the world more important to you? Wouldn't you stake your life in this contest? I think you have already, and perhaps, if Maury is correct, the lives of others.
Hell, I said. Love is an American cult. We take it too seriously. It's practically a national religion. The simulacrum did not speak. It rocked back and forth instead. It's serious to me, I said.
Then that is what you must consider, not whether it is properly serious to others or not. I think it would be inhuman to retire to a world of rent values, as Mr. Barrows will do. Is it not the truth that he stands opposite you, Louis? You will succeed precisely on that point, that to him, his feeling for Miss Priss is not serious.
And is that good?
Is that more moral or rational? If he felt as you do, he would let Mrs. Dvorak obtain her condemnation notice. He would marry Priss, and he would, in his own opinion, have obtained the better bargain. But he does not, and that sets him apart from his humanity. You would not do that. You would, and are, staking all in this. To you, the person you love matters over everything else, and I do think you are right and he wrong.
Well, thank you, I said. You know, you certainly have a deep understanding of what the proper values in life are. I have to hand it to you. I've met a lot of people, but, I mean, you go right to the core of things. The simulacrum reached out and patted me on the shoulder.
I think there is a bond between us, Louis. You and I have much in common.
I know, I said. We're alike. We were both deeply moved.